Greetings. You're listening to the CEIE podcast at Seattle University in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where life is about making meaning.
This is Kara Markell with the CEIE podcast, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with celebrated author and teacher John Philip Newell. Canadian by birth and a citizen also of Scotland, John Philip resides with his family in Edinburgh and works on both sides of the Atlantic. In 2016, he founded Earth and Soul, a Celtic initiative of study, spiritual practice, and compassionate action that offers contemplative retreats in the United States and international pilgrimage weeks on the Isle of Iona in Scotland. John Philip is a Celtic teacher and author of spirituality who calls the modern world to reawaken to the sacredness of Earth and every human being. He's authored over 15 books, including his latest award-winning publication, Sacred Earth, Sacred Soul, which was the 2022 Gold winner of the Nautilus Book Award for Spirituality and Religious Thought of the West. His forthcoming book, due in August of this year, is The Great Search, in which he looks at the great spiritual yearnings of humanity today in the context of the decline of religion as we have known it. John Philip Newell, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. You were for many years a reverend in the Church of Scotland, a minister, and these days you're perhaps better known as a sort of wandering teacher in the Celtic tradition. I've seen you described as having the heart of a Celtic bard and the mind of a Celtic scholar. Can you share with us a little bit about the journey that you have been on into the Celtic Christian tradition?
Well, I was reared in a very conservative evangelical tradition. And I look back with gratitude from my upbringing and my family of faith. And even though I've never sort of described myself theologically or spiritually in terms of the conservative evangelical Christian tradition, I realize I'm very grateful to it because one of the things it taught me or encouraged in me was an attentiveness to the heart. I think at best that that's what characterizes the conservative evangelical tradition historically, and certainly in my family upbringing, was this attention to the heart. And of course, I'm very interested in the mind. Ideas, sort of philosophical views, spirituality understandings. But a number of years ago, when engaged in an interfaith dialogue, I realized that what I'm doing, first of all, is looking to their heart, paying attention to that dimension of the human mystery, and then sort of engaging with ideas and perspective on the basis of what I'm looking for, and that is a heart-to-heart relationality with the other. And of course, in the conservative evangelical tradition, that sense of relationality applies also to the one whom we call God, but who is beyond names, beyond description. So that was my upbringing, and I realize I carry some of that with me, even though the worldview and theological understanding of that way of seeing has not been mine. When I came to study theology in Edinburgh back in the 1970s, I heard a great Scottish teacher, prophet, George MacLeod, the founder of the modern day Iona community. And he was in his 80s, I was in my 20s. He was already a sort of legend of a man. But I, for the first time in my life, I heard a Christian teacher speaking about the sacredness of earth and speaking also of the way of nonviolence, the nonviolence of Jesus, which he saw as foundational to the way of true relationship. whether that is between us individually or whether collectively as nations and as religions and as communities. And I realized I had a sense of sort of coming home when I heard him, even though I think at that stage I wasn't yet sort of clear within myself exactly what I was looking for. But when I heard him speak, I had this sort of illumination of, this is what is speaking deeply to my soul. But as it turned out, a number of weeks later, I was on the island of Iona and bumped into the great man. I think I talk about this a little bit in Sacred Earth, Sacred Soul, how after a few pleasantries, he said, "Newell, come back for a whiskey." And I don't think I had ever had a whiskey at that stage in my life, or if I had, I certainly hadn't had it before 4 o'clock in the afternoon anyway. And, so went back and had a really important first conversation with him. And also looking back, one of the things he said to me at the end of that conversation has always remained with me. And that is, he said, "Newell," we had been talking about sort of ecological concerns, about nuclear disarmament, but he said, "Newell, what are we going to do about all these things?" Mm-hmm. And that question has in many ways shaped much of my life. Not just what are we going to think about care of the earth and nonviolence. What are we going to do? What are we going to write? What are we going to try to prophetically utter? What are we going to try to do with others? Mm-hmm. So that was my sort of personal entry into the Celtic. So what I began to do was then to dig very intentionally into the utterances, writings, lives of great sort of Celtic Christian teachers over the centuries. And that's been sort of part of my contribution to what is now sort of broadly known as Celtic spirituality.
If it's at all possible, which maybe it feels like it's not, to summarize or to describe the Celtic charism or the what are the tenets of particularly Celtic Christianity that set it apart from perhaps more of a Western Roman sort of Christianity or spirituality?
Very early on in the Celtic Christian world, we have a really important teacher like Pelagius, 4th century teacher, who is much misunderstood and has been much maligned historically. Very simply, what Pelagius was teaching, and he was in a type of tension with Saint Augustine of Hippo. So as Augustine of Hippo was developing in the sort of Roman or imperial Christian tradition, what led eventually to the doctrine of original sin, which has dominated so much Western Christian thought, and is this doctrine that teaches that what is deepest in us is opposed to the divine rather than being of the divine. And Pelagius very much wanted to say that what is deepest in us is of God. And in particular, he said, when we look into the face of a newborn child, we're looking into the face of God, freshly born among us. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't, of course, just speaking about the newborn child. He was also speaking about what is deepest or most original in the depths of our being, and that is our of Godness, rather than seeing what is deep within us as opposed to the divine. That holds enormous implications for how we view ourselves, how we view our deepest energies, including our sexual energies, I mean, so much Western Christianity has encouraged a sort of doubt about what is deepest in us, and has sort of feared our sexual energies instead of seeing these as essentially in origin as a manifestation of our spirituality, or a manifestation of what it is to be made of God, and the longings for love and the longings to be reverenced in love and to truly reverence one another. So that not only provides a very different way of seeing ourselves, but seeing one another. And it has big implications in relation to how we view the wisdom of other spiritual traditions as well. Because instead of thinking that what is deepest in us is ignorance or is opposition to the divine, this has led Celtic teachers, including Pelagius at that very early stage, to look for divine wisdom and to look for divine truth way beyond the bounds of one's own nation, way beyond the bounds of one's own religion and culture, and to look with sort of expectation that we're going to receive from the divine when we are deeply in touch with other people, other traditions, other religions. And then a corollary of that, or sort of absolutely sort of integrated with it, is seeing everything, every life form, as a theophany, that is, as a showing of the divine, and as one of the sort of 6th century Celtic teachers said, if you wish to know the creator, then come to know the creatures. And I mean, that's a pretty obvious statement, but in many ways, it's an obvious statement that we've missed in a lot of our Western theology and religion. There's been a sense of looking beyond, looking to the transcendent alone for the divine, rather than looking for the immanent, looking deep within everything that has life. And one of my favorite teachers in the Celtic world, a 9th century Irish teacher called John Scotus Ar Eugena, he said that everything is a theophany, everything is a showing of the divine. And he speaks of the divine as like this flow of the divine that is deep within everything, like a subterranean flow, deep within all things. And he says, if somehow that river of the divine that is flowing through all things, if it was somehow dammed up or stopped, then everything would cease to exist. So the divine is not just to be found in some people or some species or, you know, some religions or some places. It's to be looked for in everything that has being, and it's to be looked for always. You know, now I'm being invited to look for the divine in the light of your eyes, and, you know, in the essence of your being, and that changes how we approach relationship, and how we see the interrelatedness of everything in the cosmos. I think so much of our Western Christian inheritance has been based on a type of hierarchy of truth, almost as if truth is dispensed from above, rather than truth being released from deep within. And you know, it even affects how I go about teaching or writing. That I see any words that I offer, whether in written form or spoken form, these are offered in order to awaken wisdom and truth that is already in the heart of the listener. And so instead of the sort of hierarchy of truth and truth being dispensed and saying this is what you must believe in order to be saved, or that, you know, this is what you need to believe in order to access truth, it's a matter of releasing truth and knowing that the well of wisdom is living and it's deep within everything that has being, And there are things that we, there are truths that we know nothing about yet. You know, rather than seeing truth as, oh, it's all been sewn up, it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's all been declared and defined in doctrine and statement. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sort of organic and I think very evolutionary understanding mm-hmm. of awareness and wisdom that the Celtic world invites us into. So it wasn't characterized by hierarchy the same way as so much Western Christianity has been.
You mentioned earlier sort of this encounter you had with George MacLeod and connecting with this Celtic spirituality as a sort of coming home, a sense of coming home. You talk about how people who perhaps have grown up or were raised in a particular tradition now feel a disconnection with that tradition or are even in some cases leaving what we might call religious trauma. And that category of people, if we can put them into a single category, is certainly in the United States a growing category of people who identify as spiritual but not religious, or we call them the nones, N-O-N-E-S, here in the Pacific Northwest. They identify as nothing in particular when it comes to religion or spirituality. That segment is growing. What do we need to know about these exiles? Not as a way of bringing them back to the church. That's not at all what I have in mind. But what wisdom do those exiles carry with them? And what should be our posture towards them?
Yeah, for many years I've been increasingly attentive to and aware of the fact that hundreds of thousands and I think probably millions of our brothers and sisters who began life very much within the four walls of Christianity as we've known it. So we're living in a time of religious exile, or one of the terms that I have found helpful is to speak of the diaspora of those who have left their religious homeland and they're scattered. So the book of mine, The Great Search, that's coming out in August, is written very much with the diaspora in mind, or a sense of this exile. And my essential approach in that book has been to say, well, what are we yearning for? What are the great longings within the human soul today that so many have not found being addressed or nurtured within the walls of religion as we have known it? In the book, I'm looking at this the longing, for instance, that is very accentuated within so many of us and within so many disciplines, is to come back into true relationship with Earth. Mm. And the reality is that sort of for so much of our Christian West history, there's not been a deep integration of reverence for Earth. We've been focused on a theology, that is an understanding of the divine as somehow above us or beyond us and not also deep within. And you know, someone like the prophet Thomas Berry, the eco-theologian, he in fact is one that I focus on early in the book. He says we are essentially earthlings, and you know, we need to see ourselves as originating in not only in Earth but in the great bursting forth of light at the beginning of the cosmos. That in essence, that's where I began. That's where you began. Mm-hmm. That, and that's not only my physical essence, that's my spiritual essence as well, to see everything as essentially both physical and spiritual. So there's the longing to come back into true relationship with Earth, a spirituality of intimacy with Earth rather than a type of spirituality of alienation from Earth. Related to the desire to come back into true relationship with Earth is is the awareness of the need to come back into true relationship with the feminine as expression of the divine. And again, so much not only of our religion, but our culture, our political structures and so on have been dominated by a form of shadow masculine energy that has arrayed itself up over against the earth and against the feminine. I think that there's also a great yearning to experience, there's a longing to experience the divine rather than to simply accept propositional statements about the divine. And I think part of this is the great search for spiritual practice and spiritual experience rather than sort of doctrinal beliefs about the divine. So those are some of the things that I explore in the new book. I'm asking, what are we yearning for? Because I think that paying attention to the deepest yearnings of our being, the yearnings of our soul, is what will clarify for us what the road ahead should be. In 2018, it was when I realized that I should relinquish my ordination within the Church of Scotland, and that was not primarily wanting to act in judgment against my religious tradition. So it was important for me to let go of ordination in order to stand more clearly and more openly and more freely with the great diaspora, with those in exile, and say I'm part of this search. But I think that one of the great things about our Judeo-Christian inheritance is that it is always, not always comfortably, but it's always made room for the prophetic. It's always said, you know, sometimes truth speaks to us from the wilderness and not from the temple. That's where I've placed myself much more intentionally, trying to be a voice calling out. And my hope, of course, and this is true of the prophetic tradition, you know, when you think of it in our Hebrew scriptures and in our Christian tradition, the prophet speaks in order or out of love for the family to which he or she belongs. So it's not a being in the wilderness in order to denounce it, denounce my family of faith, but to say we need to change. And the fact that so many are no longer entering the four walls because their deep yearnings are not being addressed is an expression of the deep disillusionment with religion as we've known it.
Yes, I often imagine, and I'm a clergy person myself, and perhaps instead of being fearful about the terrain of change that's happening here, one author refers to it as a sort of yard sale or garage sale in the church, that we're kind of getting rid of everything and sort of changing things up. There's a lot of fear and anxiety around that, but what if spirit was actually leading us here? That gives me more hope to say there are people out there with yearnings and to say from the Celtic perspective that yearnings are trustworthy, that our yearnings are our spirit moving in us, in our communities, into something new, into an awakening. I think that's a really beautiful way to hold this uneven terrain in the Christian church at this particular time.
Yeah, and you know, to reverence our yearnings is not, of course, to say that we're infallible in terms of how we read and interpret our yearnings, but it's to say that deeper than any confusions in us or not knowing within us is the holy yearning for wisdom and for truth and for encounter with the holy. So to speak about paying attention to our yearnings is not, for instance, to throw me into a place of subjective individualism in which, you know, whatever I think I'm yearning for is the way forward. And one of the disciplines in the Celtic world that has meant a lot to me, and I think it's really important when we speak about yearnings. There's been a practice of having what's called an anam cara, or a lover of the soul or a friend of the soul. And that can either be another individual, or it can be more of a sort of group of individuals to whom one shows one's soul. So my relationship with my the anam cara in my life, people who love me, is the practice of showing what I'm longing for, to try to articulate it. And sometimes it's in the attempt to articulate it that we come to a clearer consciousness of what we're longing for. And it's very important that things move up into the conscious realm, because that's also where we can translate our yearnings also into action. Well, how, you know, if this is what I'm longing for, then how do we live? How do I serve Earth and serve the human community at this moment in time? So in part, the role of the anam cara, you know, and I expect this from people to whom I show my soul, and that is, I expect them sometimes to say, well, Jean-Philippe, who do you think you're kidding? I mean, you know, this sounds a very convenient journey. So, you know, part of the struggle that we are involved in is also to know, well, what will satisfy my deepest yearnings? Mm. And that calls for real wisdom and real discernment. So to speak of this, the Celtic stream of wisdom as sort of rejecting hierarchy and paying attention to yearnings is not to suggest that whatever we think we want is
right.
Way forward.
Exactly. We call that in the Ignatian tradition our discernment, right?
Where yes, that's where we, right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and to know that we do that together, and not ever thinking that we don't need one another's wisdom to be able to discern the path ahead.
You mentioned earlier your visit to Iona to be in the presence of George MacLeod. Iona is a significant place, a sacred place in the Celtic imagination. I know that you do many retreats there as well. Can you tell us more about Iona and what makes it so special?
George MacLeod, I think, was maybe the first person to use the term a thin place when he spoke of Iona as a thin place in which heaven and earth are seen not as separate, but as intermingled, and a thin separation between spirit and matter, between heaven and earth, between those who have gone before us and ourselves. And I think that's a very beautiful way of speaking of Iona. And of course, he wasn't at all wanting to suggest that Iona is the only thin place in the world, and he certainly wasn't wanting to suggest that every other place is thick. I think he was meaning that in the history of the sort of unfolding life and energy and spirituality of that island, there's been something about the place that has invited a type of awareness of heaven in earth, spirit in matter, the divine in the human. And one of the interesting things to me about Iona is that it appears to have been a thin place, or a place of pilgrimage, even before it became a place of Christian wisdom. Mm. So Columba of Iona, the 6th century saint who we especially honor and remember as being part of the birth of Christ wisdom on that island, he spoke of Christ as his druid, for instance, and that was a way of honoring the spiritual tradition that preceded Christianity in the Celtic world. So Christ wisdom was not seen as opposed to the Druidic pre-Christian wisdom, but rather was seen as bringing it into further expression or new and deeper expression. Mm. And so Iona's been, clearly has been a place of pilgrimage for hundreds of years, even before the birth of Christianity on Iona. You know, most great traditions have these places of pilgrimage, especially thin places that invites our presence. The other thing that George MacLeod said about Iona that I've always appreciated is that while it's a place in which we more readily encounter a sense of heaven or a sense of the spirit, it's not a place where we are all to stay. You know, he saw Iona as a place of retreat, a place of pilgrimage, in order to be able to return to our home communities, in order to return to the places of struggle and confrontation in our world, and to look for the thinness also of those places, to look for spirit and matter everywhere, and to look for the divine and the human everywhere. So Iona is a sort of clarifying place, but in order to then return strengthened, engaged. So what is it about Iona? Is this a sort of energy related to the place, or is it also to do with the fact that it's been a place of pilgrimage for hundreds of years, a place to which people go very intentionally to access more deeply the wisdom of the soul and the prophetic challenges of what it is to be a servant of truth. And so I think for me it's both. I think there is something about and sort of someone once explained to me that just as the human body has places of special sensitivity or aliveness in us, so it is with the body of earth. And that in part is the sort of whole theory of ley lines, that there are special sort of intersections of energy in places like Iona and other places of pilgrimage. But I think it's not just the place. I think it's also the sort of accumulation of people going there. And part of what it means in Iona, I mean, on Iona, no one happens to pass through Iona.
That's right.
You know, it's not sort of en route anywhere. It's on the edge of Europe. Everyone who arrives has decided very intentionally to be there. And I think there's something about that intentionality, including spiritual intentionality, that can make it an extraordinary place. And this is what I find in our 1 week pilgrimage events that we run four times a year on Iona. And that is, people arrive in a very open state, of heart and mind. And when that happens, you know, get ready for something really important to unfold. Yes. And Columba of Iona, one of the rules that he offered his own community in the 6th century was pray until the tears come. Mm. And I've always seen that as a very beautiful understanding. I mean, Carl Jung says, when we weep, something in the salt sea of life's origins is stirring in us again. When we have a deep encounter of love, or when we have a deep encounter with truth, often it is tears that express the fact that something very profound is stirring in us. And in my many years on Iona, I've met countless numbers of people who have arrived on the island, and they don't know anything about Columba's rule from the 6th century. And they, you know, will say things to me like, when I stepped on this island, I began to weep. You know, what's that about? And I think it is something to do with the place, but I think it's also something to do with the hundreds of years of prayer, intentionality, and willingness to be challenged.
One thing I've always appreciated about your teaching, your prophetic teaching, is that it never really gives over to despair. And so I want to ask you, what do you see awakening in the world that gives you hope?
First of all, a story of hope that I always love about the Dalai Lama. I remember seeing him being interviewed one time, and he was asked if he had hope for the world. And, you know, here's a man who's known exile from his own people, from his own land. So he stands with so many in the world who have known that path of suffering. Of course, when he was asked the question, he laughed. And of course, this is part of his charism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting, isn't it, when you compare the Dalai Lama from the world of Buddhism with someone like Desmond Tutu from Christian. I mean, what characterizes these people? Often a willingness to laugh. And part of their laughter is something to do with not taking our egos too seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he laughed, and then he said, "Of course I have hope. The future has not yet been decided."
Mm.
And I think often we live as if the future has already been decided. I think we often conform almost to, well, there will always, you know, there will always be these divisions between nations, or this is what human nature, you know, this sort of more pessimistic approach to human nature. So I love that story because I think that the future is there waiting for us to live responsibly into and to bring this wisdom and to bring the creativity of the divine, to bring new ways of being, new ways of seeing, to try to nurture those and be part of those birthing within us. That's a big part of it. And I mean, in some ways, this takes us back to where we began our conversation, or very early in the conversation, and that is, how do we define our essence? And do we define our essence in terms of original sin, or what is deepest in us being opposed to God? Or do we define ourselves in terms of being of God, and therefore, to be made of God in part is to be made of imagination, and in this capacity to actually see things differently, and this capacity to be part of shaping things rather than imprisoned by what has been. That's you know, part of why I see this Celtic wisdom as important for this moment in time. That's not to be a Celtic fundamentalist and suggest that everyone needs to access this tradition. But I think that it is a tradition that is full of hope, not in a naive way, not in a way that's blind to or shuts down to just how horrendous some of the suffering and wrong is. We need a prophetic voice of saying no to the abuses that are happening, no to the genocide of what's happening in Gaza, no to the deep wrongs that are occurring. But no is only part of what we are to live into. And yes is the other word, yes to the beautiful and sacred depths within every human being. And how do we keep looking to allow those to be born anew or to come forth in new ways.
Yeah, thank you. One of the characteristics of Celtic Christianity that I love is this practice of blessing, even all the way back to the Carmina Gedalica, just filled with blessings for sort of every moment of life, and the mundane and the mystical all together. I'm wondering if you would, as we kind of close our time together, if you would offer a blessing to our listeners.
Yeah, I'm delighted to do this. And the one that I'd like to offer is blessing for peace. But before I do that, I want to share a sort of brief story with you about my father. late in his life, he entered a time of dementia in which many things weren't as clear to him as they had been, and he found it very difficult often to find words or articulation as he moved further and further into his dementia. But interestingly, something that never left him was the capacity to bless. And one of his favorite blessings was sometimes known as the priestly blessing in the Hebrew tradition, the Lord bless you and keep you. Mm-hmm. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Mm-hmm. This oldest of blessings in the Hebrew tradition. So in my father's last months, he would give this blessing to everyone. I joined him in the nursing home that he was in at the very end. And there were, you know, in the dining room, there were maybe 15 tables, each with sort of five or six people at each table. Mm. And he said to the people at his own table, he said, "Excuse me, now I need to bless the people." Mm. And he would go from table to table and give this blessing. Mm. And I got to see how beautiful it was for him. And I got to see people's faces light up at being blessed. Mm. This is something we can actually do for one another. We can actually bless one another because within us, much deeper than ego, is divine presence. Mm. And we can find words to carry blessing from that deep place within us to one another. It's been really instructive for me to see that when my father was losing many of his skills of articulation and thought, he was still living from that very beautiful place of wanting to bless and knowing how important blessing is. So this is a blessing that comes from the Western Isles of Scotland. It's very much part of the expression of the Celtic in the Scottish context, and it's a blessing for peace. Deep peace of the running wave to you. Deep peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the Son of Peace to you. Amen.
Amen. Friends, you can find out more about John Phillips' work at earthandsoul.org. You can find his writing just about anywhere. I encourage you to do so. John Philip Newell, what a gift it has been to be in conversation with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen. Blessing to be with you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the CEIE podcast at SU. Visit our Theolab at religica.org or the renowned International Journal of Local Stories from around the world at theinterfaithobserver.org and participate in emerging opportunities at our main website. That's seattleu.edu/CEIE. Thank you.